From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in December 2013 when the Rochester Area Community Foundation released a new report on poverty. It was not a surprise that Rochester was struggling with poverty. What made the report so powerful was how detailed it was and how dire a picture it painted of Rochester. The report put poverty in context. Children living in poverty, families living in extreme poverty, and the concentration of poverty in the city. Put it all together, and Rochester ranked as the second poorest city of its size in our country. Local leaders responded at the time by calling poverty an emergency. They called the situation with child poverty a moral failing. Ed Doherty, the author of the report, said that poverty in Rochester should shock our conscience. Roughly 50% of Rochester children lived in poverty, and a majority of Rochester City School District elementary students were in classrooms where 90% of the students were living in poverty. Doherty told us on Connections, quote, "What we may not be grappling with well enough is the degree which the concentration of poverty is destroying an entire generation of young people. It's how young our poverty is. It's how dramatically it is concentrated. It's how that concentration of poverty in a single school district makes educational success nearly impossible," end quote. Not long after that report came out, a new initiative was born, RMAPI, the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. Doherty cautioned us not to expect massive reductions in poverty in just a year or two. "This is a long-term mission," he said. The first executive director of RMAPI, Leonard Brock, put an ambitious goal on the table at the time. Brock said that RMAPI's goal was to cut poverty by 50% in 15 years. By the time that Brock stepped down from his position nearly 5 years later, poverty was not declining in Rochester. Census data showed that poverty went from 32.8% in 2013 to 33.1% when Brock stepped down. Now fast forward to late spring of this year. New York State Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli released a report calling for new approaches to dealing with poverty in cities across our state. Rochester remained in the top five poorest cities in the country in its size category. And the report read, quote, "Albany, Syracuse, Rochester, and Buffalo have child poverty rates that are double the average rate of their cohort cities," end quote. And today, nearly half of Rochester children are living in poverty. Entering year 10 of RMAPI, the overall numbers are not much different. Leonard Brock's goal of cutting poverty by 50% in 15 years looks unrealistic. And to be fair, RMAPI has said, the goal should be different. But why? Why is this so difficult? The current leadership at RMAPI points to modest improvements in poverty in the past 5 years. We'll talk about that today. But no one entered this work looking to make modest gains. The people who work in this field will tell you they feel the urgency. They view poverty as a tragedy. They want these initiatives to work. Today, we're bringing you a special edition of Connections on the Road with a live audience, broadcasting from the Monroe Community College downtown campus, which is the host of today's RMAPI Summit, the third such anti-poverty summit. The theme of this year's summit is Connections That Count, appropriately enough. In our second hour of Connections, we're going to welcome Rochester Mayor Malik Evans, along with our MAPI and community leaders. And in our first hour, we're understanding the challenges that poverty brings. Let me welcome our guests now. Reverend Myra Brown is with us, Executive Director of the Black Community Focus Fund and Lead Pastor of Spiritus Christi Church. Reverend, welcome back to the program.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Also with us in studio is Dr. Ashley Cross, Founder and Executive Director of Hope 585. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome in studio to Daniel Jones, who is a parent, a licensed mental health counselor, a certified birth doula, and member of the single female head of household cohort at RMAPI. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You can hear the live audience there. Welcome to the audience. Thank you all for being here as well. And let me also let our guests on stage know, since our first time on a setting like this, just make sure those microphones are even closer than you think. I think we probably can't be too close to our microphones. We want everyone to hear you. I want to start briefly with Reverend Brown, because Reverend Brown, you've helped in many ways with GBI, Guaranteed Basic Income Program for the city of Rochester, helped administer that. And we've seen a number of people, we're going to hear from them this hour, about what it has meant to get a check every month that you know that you can use, no strings attached. Why don't you describe for us what you've seen in the last year with that?
Yeah. I think in the last year, it's been an incredible program. I absolutely think that we should have a permanent GBI program in the city of Rochester.
A permanent one.
Poverty is a choice. And every child really should experience the joy of childhood. and poverty ravishes the souls of children, and it interrupts that vision from actually happening. And so, you know, it's our responsibility as a community to create the conditions by which children and families can thrive. So what I've seen is the GBI program, first of all, we had over 16,000 people apply for it, right? That gave us kind of a read of how deep the poverty is in our community. And we could only choose 351, this random selection, and we split them into two cohorts, 175 and 176. And then we ended up over the course of the year, we lost two people to death, and we lost one person who moved out of the country. So we ended up with a total of 348 people that we serviced. But parents told us a lot of things, individuals and parents. We were able to help people who were homeless find housing, and to be able to then have that be a step to additional resources that they would need for their lives. We were able to see families who were living in cars find housing. People were able to get jobs, better jobs. We saw families and individuals who were able to start and invest in a new business, to get on their feet. We saw families who were able to have their basic needs met. I enrolled a woman, and I asked her, you know, what do you think these dollars will do for you? And she said, I hope that these dollars will help to stop the cycle of off. And I said, what do you mean, stop the cycle of off? She said, well, you know, I never have enough to pay my bills and to keep my lights on and to keep food in the refrigerator. And so my daughter, I have one daughter, and she's always coming to me every month with tears in her eyes saying, Mommy, how come we can't keep our TV on? How come we can't keep our lights on? Mommy, how come we never have enough food in the refrigerator? And the mom just began to weep with me. She said, so I'm just hoping that these dollars will stop the cycle of off. And that's what GBI has done for so many families in this community. We have the power to do that, and it is a moral crisis if we don't.
Briefly, Reverend, you said that poverty is a choice, and the way that hit my ears was that it's a choice that a community, a city, a country makes.
Absolutely.
But I want you to make sure that that I heard that correctly from you. How do you describe poverty as a choice?
Policy is a choice because poverty is a choice because it's a result of policies and practices and decisions that are made about the lives of people and how we think they ought to live. I mean, even the percentage levels of poverty that we decide that people should live at a certain level in order to then be able to have certain resources and qualify for them. I think we have to look at the whole system and the whole ways in which we've made decisions about the lives of people. I would prefer that we make decisions on the idea of how do we help people to thrive. And then I think that's a different question, and I think we'll get a different answer other than how do we maintain and make sure people aren't too poor, which I think is kind of what our systems right now, how they're constructed.
And just a couple... with a live audience today on this broadcast of Connections. In just a couple of minutes, we're going to hear from a couple of GBI recipients about what this year has been like for them. I want to ask Dr. Cross to describe a little bit about what Hope 585 does. And if you could, tell us a little bit about TAP Legacy, which is a different program, but maybe a similar mission.
Yeah, about 2 years ago, we started the TAP Legacy Fund, which is a cash assistance program for families that are navigating multiple systems, mainly Child Protective Services. And so we serve 150 families a year, and we've been able to give out $245,000 over the span of 2 years to families that are navigating Child Protective Services. Many are working on reunification, getting their child back, trying to keep their children out of foster care. So again, talking about the impact of poverty, right? Not only does it diminish the soul of a child, but it can also break up a family.
And to that end, it's, you know, over time, maybe data will help elucidate more about what's quote unquote working. And I think it matters. Metrics matter. We'll talk about that in our second hour in more depth here. But even early on, I think you told me before the program that you've seen some indications that you think this is a program that works.
Yeah, majority of our families use their funding, 70% use their money for housing, right?
For housing.
It is for housing. It's for, you know, a father who is working to keep their children out of the foster care system that needs a larger home, right? And so he needs now to move out of a small, you know, apartment to now a home, right? And so using it to be able to keep families together. Out of 148 checks that we gave this year, 118 of those individuals are employed. Right. So then the question becomes, right, well, who should these cash assistance programs be servicing? And I think it helps also address the misconception that people are poor because they don't have jobs or they don't want to work. Right. And so for us, we're actually servicing the working class poor that are really just trying to keep their families together.
That perception, a stereotype that's out there, is what has led to a lot of opposition to whether it's UBI, GBI, direct cash assistance. It's probably why, until the last decade or so, we've seen a lot of assistance programs be a lot more strings attached, mm-hmm. very directed. You can use it for this, but not this. This is only for housing. This is for food, but not this food. You're describing a very different reality that you have seen. And I want you to describe for listeners, not just poverty, but what you see in terms of trauma and how layered and challenging this is in reality for people living it.
Yeah, and one of the things I hope 585 focuses on is just the impact of systemic trauma, right? Like there is trauma that our families, when they come to us, they've experienced so much trauma, and it's not just poverty, right? And so when we're even looking at poverty, we're always talking about finances or resources, but it's also a lack of relationships. And so the families that come to us, when we see them and we're sitting with them, they don't have a safety net. They don't have someone to call, which is typically how they got in the situation that they're in, right? They didn't have someone to call to watch their children, right? And so it's just compounded trauma. It's trauma upon trauma. And so we always talk about adverse childhood experiences, but we're also not talking about the adverse community environments, right? And so people have compounded trauma, and there's really no way that we can, I think, tackle the issue of poverty without having conversations about trauma and community well-being.
Well, let me ask you. This is a Live Connections broadcast. Well, they're all live. Most of them are live. But it's a live audience today from MCC with the RMAPI Summit today. The audience should know that later in the hour and in our second hour, if you want to ask questions, we do have microphones set up around the premises here. But I want to turn, before we get to a guest on the phone, let me ask Daniel Jones, who's with us, a little bit about the work that you're doing, not just with RMAPI now, but to share your experience, your own, to use a popular phrase, lived experience. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yes. So I am a single mom of two. I have a son that's 10 and my daughter is 2. As you shared, I work as a mental health counselor. That is a large part of the work that I do. And just from my own experience of growing up in poverty, watching, you know, how my mom and my dad tried to take care of us and tried to shield certain things from us. But you know, hearing the story that Reverend Myra shared that about the little girl that notices those things, right? So they try to shield things, but you can't shield the lights being off, right? Or you can't shield not having enough food to eat or watching your parents not eat to make sure that you are able to eat, right? And so having experienced that and knowing that I wanted to change that experience for my own children, I still have that desire to do that. It definitely has been a struggle. So, you know, just being in poverty myself, working two jobs just to make ends meet, right? And not meeting those income guidelines to get the help that I need, right? And that's something else. I was trying my best not to say like, amen, yes, start clapping while they were talking because they were spot on with a lot of this stuff, right? And being told like you have to make under this amount of money just for us to help you makes me feel as a single parent like I have to just be barely making it in order to just get some support so that I can like step it up a little bit, right?
The ultimate damned if you do, damned if you don't, right?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Exactly. That's exactly what it is. But my experience really pushed me into wanting to work with single moms and being a part of the single moms group with RMAPI has been amazing. Just being able to be invited to sit at different tables to share my experience, to give input, to, you know, certain organizations and the work that they're doing, just be able to share some feedback with them, which I think is important because if you're trying to build programs that will help the community, you need to hear from the community, right? I never understand how people who may not live these experiences are the ones that are trying to make those choices for us to decide, hey, this is what this family needs. And it's like, no, I don't need that, right? Another family may need that, but let me give you a different view of what it is that I need, right? Every family is not the same. So what I may need, another family may not need, right? But also it's like, you can't tell me what I need to be successful, right? And to be able to feel comfortable and stable with providing for my family. And so in my work as a mental health counselor, I pride myself on working with moms, single moms, because I understand the struggle and I understand that, just like Dr. Ashley said, it's not all about financial wellness, right? It's about our physical health, our mental health, our emotional health, and also the well-being of our children, right? It doesn't just stop with us. Like, our kids matter to us. So if our kids are not good, we're ultimately not going to be good, right? It's like a whole family system approach.
Well, 2 years ago, you told us that a lot of single parents, often single mothers, not always, they pour everything into making sure their kids can eat, can have a life, can have what they need, and there's almost nothing left in terms of energy and a life for themselves. How are you doing? I mean, I thought that was a powerful point when I first heard it, and I know you think about that a lot. You work on that. How are you doing?
Yeah, So I kind of see like a cycle, right? So my son is 10, my daughter is 2. So for almost 7 years, it was just my son and I. And I started out working 2 jobs. I literally would work from 8 to 4. I would get off, pick him up from daycare, drop him off to someone else, and go to my second job from 5 to 10. Pick him up, he's asleep. Put him in the bed, I get in the bed, and I get back up and do it all over again. And so, yes, the money was there for me to feel like I was, you know, able to take care of us, but I was missing that time with my son, right? I was missing milestones. I was missing doing the homework. I was missing, you know, being able to put him in sports because I wanted him to do those things. So when I finally got to a space where it's like, okay, I think I'm doing better, right? My daughter comes along and it's like, now I kind of feel like I'm back into that cycle, because just when I felt like I was doing better, it's like the bar is moved again, right? Like, you got to stretch your money a little bit more because the economy is horrible right now, right? So just when I feel like I'm doing good, it's like the bar is moved again and it's, you feel like I thought I was making it and now I'm back to this cycle of working 2 jobs again, right? And it does take a lot out of you. It doesn't leave a lot of time for self-care. It definitely makes you have to rely on your village. And unfortunately, everybody doesn't have a village, right? And I'm thankful that I have a village. I've been able to build a village for me. But sitting with some of the single moms that I do support, they don't have people that they can reach out to, that they can call on, you know, when they need that support, or just to have somebody to encourage them that, you know, everything is going to be okay. So single parenting is hard, right? But I always say single parenting is a beast. And it does take a certain level of just energy and drive and definitely a certain level of like mental and emotional wellness to really be able to get through it. And I think sometimes, well, I hear my clients tell me, like, if I do some self-disclosure and let them know, you know, I've battled depression, I've battled anxiety, I have my moments, right? There's days where I'm a complete mess, but I still show up for my clients. And I will hear them say, like, you don't look like someone that would be dealing with that. Or because you're a mental health counselor, I would think that you have it all together. And it's like, no, I don't. Because as they say, life be lifing, right? And even as a mental health counselor and, you know, a single mom of 2, like, I still have my struggles, but I'm thankful for my village. And I think that's important, and that's something I really try to help people with, is building a village for them, like helping them to figure out, how do I build the village? How do I get those people around me that I need so that I can be well for myself and my children?
2 hours is not going to be enough connections today. Can everybody stay all day? Danielle, just briefly here, you work with RMAPI.
Yes.
What's one of the top items right now on your list where you would say to policymakers, this is not happening and this is what we need most right now? Is there something that's at the top of that list?
Yes. I would say mental health care. We need... So when it comes to mental health and taking insurance, right? So when it comes to Medicaid, just the reimbursement rate is so low. So you're seeing therapists that may not take Medicaid, right? So then that lowers the number of therapists that people have access to. And so, you know, our people that receive Medicaid, they are the ones with the lower income that are living in poverty, right? So I just don't understand how our people that are living in poverty that are facing some of the most traumatic situations, the most, you know, harmful experiences. Why is it that the state is paying less for their care, right? And then that limits their ability to be connected with a therapist of their choice. And especially if we're talking about Black individuals being paired with a Black therapist, I get that a lot, that people want a Black therapist, but they just can't find it. And I understand, right? Therapists also have to make a living. So there's a few of them that choose not to take Medicaid. And it's like, I get it, right? You still have to live, and you know that you won't get paid as much for doing Medicare or doing Medicaid clients. But then again, that limits the people that are available, and people get pushed into like the community mental health centers, which is great that they're there, but I've worked in them, so I know how it goes. And you get to see your therapist for maybe 30 minutes every 2 to 3 weeks. That's not therapy, right? We're just putting a Band-Aid over it and hoping that that person makes it from this week to the next 3 weeks.
Dr. Cross, top of the list for Danielle was therapy and dealing with, in her words, traumatic situations. Trauma is tied up in a lot of the work that I know that you do. And before the program, you and I were talking about how if our engine fries on our car, it's an inconvenience, we can figure it out. It's not going to likely lead to a loss of job. But trauma happens when so many different things start to spiral. And I just want you to kind of put a point on that before we move to our guest on the phone.
Yeah, I mean, families are in crisis. And like I said, if my engine blows, I have social capital. I have access to people. So it's not, again, it's not just the access to finances. I have access to people who can help me until I figure out an option. And we have families, just like Danielle said, that do not have a village. Right. And so, again, it only exacerbates the issue. It creates more trauma. Right. So you talk about families who leave children at home because they don't have child care. Right. Like, how does that? It's not that they just can't pay for child care. They also don't have someone that's trusted and safe. So a lot of times we say families don't just make bad choices. They actually don't have any good choices to choose from. Like, because we'll always say, well, why did you do this? Why? These were my options. I had three really bad options, and I had to choose which one for me was the lowest risk of them all. And that's it. And that sometimes only moves into another traumatic situation.
Reverend is nodding over there. And that's also what leads to a lot of stereotypes when people who have never experienced that wonder about the choices that Dr. Cross just described, Myra. Yeah.
No, I think that's true. You know, you don't understand poverty unless you've been there. And I think it's a problem that you have people making decisions about and policy around poverty that have never really experienced it. Like, they really don't know. You know, I grew up in a family of eight. We grew up in poverty, you know, all of my childhood life. And so when you've been there, you learn to not have a tolerance for it. And I think that's what we have to do. Like, we have to stop having tolerance for poverty. It doesn't serve us. It doesn't serve anybody. It's not our friend, right? And so we have to really lean in, I think, on the leaders and policymakers and communities to let's just get rid of it. Let's stop messing around. Let's just get rid of it. It's been around way too long. It's ravaged families way too long, right? Let's step into our power that we have to change our society, change our policies, right, to take some risks that we need to take. And let's get rid of the darn thing.
You're all free to applaud whenever you want. they all looked at the stage and said, can I? We are broadcasting live from MCC's downtown campus today as part of our MAPPIES Summit, the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. Connections both hours with a live audience on the road today. And on the phone, I want to bring in Maya Reagan, who is a Rochester resident. And one of the 351 Reverend...
348 now.
348. There were 351 people chosen to be part of the GBI program. That's Guaranteed Basic Income. It's a program that is about wrapping up right about now, a one-year-long program. And Maya, can you hear us? How are you?
Hi, I'm doing good. Can you guys hear me?
We can. We're on the road here, and I think our audience can hear you pretty well, too. So why don't you just describe, Maya, a little bit about yourself and what the last year has been like as part of the GBI program.
Hi. So the last year's part of the GBI program has honestly changed so much in my life. In the beginning of 2023, I was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. And I also found out that I was pregnant. So during that time was probably the hardest. Excuse me, sorry, I don't mean to be emotional. The hardest time of my life. And I don't think I had any hope for, getting out of the situation that I was in, with, bills piling up as I was not able to work, due to my, chemotherapy. And then, the GBI program came around, and I thought that I would apply just to see if I would, be one of the people that were chosen, and I was. And I was so thankful to get some sort of relief. It started when my son was first born. So he just turned one a few days ago. And it's been such a help towards, rent and the expenses towards having a newborn child and just going through these health issues. It's helped so much.
Maya, how is he doing?
Oh, he's doing amazing. He is thriving. He's an amazing little boy.
How are you doing these days?
I'm doing good. I had a stem cell transplant in March. I haven't fully been able to go back to work, but I am also taking classes at MCC in criminal justice in hopes of becoming a lawyer one day. but as of now, my cancer is in remission. And I'm doing good.
Yay, Maya.
I hope you hear that whole room of people who, they gasped when they heard your story, Maya. And that applause, I hope you're feeling that love, that sense of community, that village that Danielle talked about. Can you just describe as well, now that GBI is ending, it seems like it's helped you get through the last year. Do you have to make adjustments now that that monthly check is not going to be there?
I would say small adjustments, as now I am able to go back to work, but not fully, but in some sorts, which would probably fill that gap from the $500 that I won't be receiving. It honestly given me such an opportunity to focus on my health and raising my child. And I'm so appreciative of it.
Well, Reverend, can you just describe a little bit about what it has been like in this program with people like Maya? I'm not sure we were ready for that kind of story.
Yeah. Hi, Maya. It's me, Reverend Myra.
Hi.
So Maya brings up a great point. We had several participants who were selected for GBI who had cancer, and we're going through cancer treatments. And the last thing you need when you're going through cancer treatments is additional stress, right? And so GBI Dollars was really able to contribute to people's mental health because it lowered their stress level because they didn't have to worry about, how am I going to make this work? How am I going to make that work? Can I afford to go to the treatment? Do I need to use my money for something else? And so it was really important for us to support folks like Maya and many of the participants as they were going through it, to not only just, you know, those dollars that really helped them to kind of lower the stress and give them extra resources, but to be there for them, you know, as a sounding board, to walk with people, right, to create a different relationship, right, to address some of the institutional, the systemic and social trauma that they were coming with already. And so I just think, you know, it's so important to make sure that people who are struggling with poverty have what they need. You know, if we can send billions to foreign countries to have war, we can absolutely put billions right here in our cities across America to end poverty. So people like Maya and others do not have to live with that daily stress of waiting for the other shoe to drop. Like, we can do this.
Maya, what would the last year have been like for you if you didn't have GBI?
I'm not quite sure. I probably struggling to get by with rent and any other bills. I don't know, because I haven't really thought about what it would be like without it right now.
Maya, before we let you go, and I just want to thank you for telling your story today. You know, this city, this state, this country has a lot of decisions to make about what happens next in dealing with poverty. And you just heard Reverend Brown talking about some of her preferences, and Danielle's talked about policies and changes she'd want to see. One of the reasons that people, when people say they don't like a UBI or a GBI, it's because sometimes opponents of those kinds of programs, they don't trust people to spend money a certain way. They believe that, you know, it's going to be wasted. It is not a good use of tax dollars. They want to sort of police and direct where the money goes to. Can you just describe, Maya, your sense of, what would you say to somebody who felt like, well, I don't know if I can trust people in that kind of a program to use the money, quote unquote, wisely?
I think I would say you would never know until we actually try that, and we actually try giving the people a universal basic income. I agree with what Reverend Myra said. If we have billions of dollars to send for war, you don't even know what those are going for, besides weapons and all that stuff. But giving the money back into to the people of the state and the United States, it's going back into our economy, and it's ultimately it's gonna bring change inside the actual states and into the people's lives.
My last question for you, in 5 years from now, if you're doing what you want to be doing, what does life look like for you?
Hopefully I will be pretty close to becoming a lawyer. I am studying criminal justice, like I said before, at MCC. I am in hopes to become a criminal defense lawyer or family court lawyer, and just living comfortably with my family. Yeah.
Maya Reagan, thank you for making time for Connections today.
All right, thank you so much for having me.
How many stories? I mean, there's, I guess, several hundred, Reverend, and everyone's story is a little different, but. You know, if we had a chance to spend more time with GBI recipients, what else do you think we would hear?
Well, you'd hear from a father that we enrolled, who was really ashamed because he didn't have the resources. He was ashamed to go around his kids. You know, he was really just living with the stigma of being a deadbeat dad, had done everything he could and just couldn't get the resources that he needed to make his kids proud and move through life. And he got selected for GBI, and it changed his whole family dynamics. He now had resources that he could take his kids to the movies. He could contribute to school clothes. You know, he could take them on vacation, and it changed everything. You know, he went from this person who was kind of demonized around the family to somebody who they could actually see. And it changed his relationship with his children. It changed his relationship with his children's mother. And it really changes a relationship within the context of a larger community. So, you know, we have to give people what they need. Poor people are some of the hardest working people in the world. They built this country. We owe them. We owe poor people. None of us would be enjoying what we're enjoying had it not been for the work of poor people.
In a moment, if there are questions, comments from the audience, I would invite anyone who wants to get up and pop into a line. I think we've got a couple of microphones. Dr. Cross, what did you hear in Maya's story there?
Yeah, I heard that we have families that are struggling with, well, first, I think just the comment about we owe poor people and that they're some of the hardest working people. Like, that is consistent with the stories that we're seeing. These are not, and I think that that's a part, I don't know that we're ever going to move past, you know, tackling, or we're never going to achieve tackling poverty if people are not challenged on what they believe about poor people. Right. Because the question about how they spend their money, it's coming from what we believe about them, what people believe about them and how they steward their money and why they're in the position that they're in the first place. It's because people think they're irresponsible. People don't think that they're working. And so that's what I heard. But that's one of the things that I just think that we have to start challenging people on what they really believe about why people are in the situations that they're in, and help highlight stories like what we're hearing now that really, it drives a different narrative.
There are entire books written telling people that they're poor because they had too many avocado toasts. I mean, it is pretty remarkable about the stereotypes about that. Before I turn to Danielle, I just want to add, kind of closing the loop on GBI. We're going to talk to Mayor Malik Evans in our second hour about his thoughts about GBI as that program wraps up here. I know you are advocating for more of it. Do you have any insight or any news you want to break here about what could be coming? That, because it is a program that is not, it's going to sunset. It's not going to go on forever here.
Yeah, so we are proposing the Black Community Focus Fund that we continue a GBI program in the city of Rochester. We're calling it the Living Waters GBI program that we're currently raising funds for. And what we'd like to target the next one for is for families with school-age children. If we have 46% of the children in our school district that are living at and below the poverty level, we believe we should target dollars to make sure that we're addressing childhood poverty in our city. And so we're proposing actually a five-year program. It's a big ask. It's a lot of money to raise, but we believe that people are worth it. And so we're kind of shaking every bush. You know, if you know people who like to contribute to helping children to thrive, and that really is our starting place, we want to make sure that children can thrive. And so we believe that we can be living water.
What's the goal? Families. What's the number that you're looking for?
The number of dollars we're looking for? For a five-year program, it's $11.2 million. But we can launch it with $330,000.
Let me turn back to Danielle Jones, who is also a parent. And, you know, listening to Maya's story, she talked about the enormous stress and then some of the relief that came in the last year, just knowing that some of the questions about whether it was childcare, rent, literally housing, was going to be ameliorated at least for a year. Can you just describe a little bit more about the idea that when you are dealing with those kinds of questions, food, rent, housing, that those can be dollars and cents on a page, but what it is like personally to deal with those questions?
Yes. So obviously those are basic needs, right? And so those are the things that, you know, I strive for my kids. Like, I need to make sure they can eat, that they have a place to live. But it goes beyond that, right? And so I think staying in this mindset of just, you know, helping people take care of their basic needs. So even hearing Reverend Myra explain, like, the dad that was able to buy clothes and take his kids to the movies, right? Give them experiences like that is important. So I can have a house, I can have food for my children, right? And we're in there and we're able to have those basic things met. But as a parent, there's more that you want to give your kids, right? I know before I've talked about like wanting my kids to be able to do extracurricular activities, right? That helps to develop them as individuals, right? With the goal of ending this poverty mindset, right? Wanting my kids to see more and experience more so that when they're asked questions, it's not just about, I just want to have a place to live and have food, right? They have experiences so they can think about other possibilities that they can do. But we're oftentimes put into this box of, I just need to have food and a place for my kids to live and transportation to get them to and from school. And as long as I got that, like, I should be okay, because that's what society tells us, that we should only be focused on those things. But that's not fair to put us in that box.
Sometimes I feel like when I hear people say, well, you know, kids are resilient, that's easy to say that when your kids don't have to experience poverty.
Exactly.
And I'm not at all saying the kids shouldn't be resilient. I mean, resilience is a good skill for anybody to have. Mm-hmm. But I think that there are judgments that are made sometimes that are kind of made from afar. How are your kids doing?
I mean, my kids are great. My kids are awesome. Just going along with like single parenting as well, I know I've shared with you before, is that, you know, my daughter has a rare medical condition that requires a lot of care, mm-hmm. right? She's seeing, I think, like 5 specialists at this point, right? And so talking about energy as a single parent, like there's days I wake up and I'm just like, oh, I can't do this today. But I have no choice, right? There's nobody else to tag in. So even off of 2 hours of sleep, I have to get up and do her medication regimen in the morning, right? I have to get up and, you know, make sure she has the things that she needs that is going to help her to get better with her medical condition, right? All the doctor's appointments, all the specialists, keeping track of everything, and having to put forth that extra energy to advocate for her in these spaces, right? And so that goes along with some of the struggles, right, of having, you can have parents that have kids with these medical conditions, and that's like an extra stress on them. Because now I'm fighting in a medical system that historically is racist. Right. And I'm having to go the extra mile to get the care that my daughter needs. I'm having to advocate so much. And at the end of the day, I'm tired mentally and emotionally, but I still have to work so that I can take care of my kids. Right. There's no tap out option for me.
We have a live broadcast happening both hours today. If you're just joining us, we are broadcasting live from RMAPI's Summit, the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, and we are at the MCC downtown campus. And I want to turn to some of the questions right here from the microphone from our audience. So a name first, and go ahead.
My name's Corinda Reeves. I'm the RMAPI chair.
Hold on 1 second, Corinda. I just want to make sure just want to turn up the microphone. So for those who are not in the room, listening wherever you listen to Connections from, we are rolling, and our team is doing a phenomenal job, but I just want to make sure everyone can hear you there. So, talk right into it there. Okay.
My name's Corinda Reeves, and I'm the RMAPI chair. Just wanted to reflect on the comments that all of the panelists made about infusing dollars into families, because we know to get out of poverty, you got to have more money. We often talk about adding more monies to budgets in addition to changing policy, but sometimes changing policy in itself infuses dollars. So during a period of time, the federal government gave child care tax credits on a quarterly basis, as opposed to giving it to families all in one lump sum. Mm-hmm. And from what I understand, that immediately lifted some families out of poverty. So I just wanted to hear from the panelists and Danielle, what impact did that have on the families that you all worked with, or Danielle, what impact did that have on you where we didn't infuse dollars, we just changed a policy?
I think you're talking about the federal child tax credit?
Correct.
That was coming in quarterly to monthly? Anyway, it wasn't one lump sum, right?
Correct.
Okay, yeah. Danielle, do you want to start?
Sure. Definitely what you said, like we need money to get out of poverty. I will say that, you know, just receiving that extra money was a support for me, because it allowed me to plan ahead for bills that I knew I was not going to be able to pay, right? And so I was able to take care of things that was going to take some stress off of myself and to allow me to breathe a little bit, right? I think just living in poverty is, you feel like you're not breathing, like you're just kind of surviving. And I didn't want to keep living in that mode. And so I feel like things like that gives us the opportunity to breathe, take a breath, right, and feel a little bit of relief. And also just increase hope that, you know, I'm going to be able to get ahead a little bit, right? I'm going to be able to no longer just survive, but to feel like I'm thriving as a parent.
Some of the professionals over at the Children's Agenda have talked about a child tax credit and are very much in favor of seeing it increased in various ways, and we may see that. There is some support on the federal level for that. We'll see. Anything you want to add there, Reverend?
I would just say that Corinda is right. I think sometimes changing policy itself is enough, because we do know that the child tax credit cut poverty in half for children in the U.S. And so we are also supporting, along with the Children's Defense Fund, the Children's Agenda, for the child tax credit to become permanent. Like, it's one thing that we can all do. We can advocate with our legislators and our policymakers to make that tax credit permanent so that we can really cut poverty, end poverty, right, for so many families in this country. I think it's big that we cut child poverty in half at 50%. And so if we make that permanent, like, you know, we can end it. We really can end it. So thank you for that.
Okay. Next up, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Barb Van Kerkhove. Thanks for everything you've spoken about today. Some of the comments that you made about, you know, that it still goes on, the individual is blamed for their circumstances. It just breaks my heart. And I'm 61 years old, and it wasn't until I was 55 years old that I learned about the doctrine of discovery. That was a series of papal bulls passed in the 1400s that underlies all of these systems of harms and oppression and the way we think of people who don't look like us. And I'm a white woman, just for people who don't see me on the radio. So in 2005, Ruth Bader Ginsburg actually wrote a Supreme Court decision against the Oneida Nation, using the doctrine of discovery as justification for her decision. So it's law in the U.S. And it says that, you know, it gave white Europeans permission to discover and take lands from indigenous peoples and to bring over and enslave Africans to work on those lands. And it's still law in the U.S. today. And I think we need to work on learning about it, understanding it from a place of understanding and not blame, but then doing the work to reverse it so we can care for everybody. And maybe I just wanted to make that statement, and I would love to hear from one or two of you.
Yeah, thank you, Barb. Reverend, do you want to start?
Yeah, I agree with what you say. I mean, we have to undo these policies. And, you know, the doctrine of discovery was a very evil doctrine, right? And, you know, I think about my grandmother. In terms of trying to blame people for poverty, I wrote an article one time called The Work Hard Fallacy, right? Because we tell poor people if they just work hard and pull themselves up by their bootstraps, you know, they can do better. My grandmother shared a story with me when I was younger that she worked in the cotton fields of the South. And my grandmother picked 400 pounds of cotton a day. And at the end of the week, she was paid $4. The prevailing wage would have been $20. And so she was cheated year after year after year after year after year, right? Those were intentional policies and practices that really went without any punitive response, right? These were allowable practices in the U.S., in the ways in which we treated Black people, the way in which we treated people of color, the way in which we treated Indigenous people. And so this practice of feeling like we can get away with treating people under white dominant cultural norms and structures has been begging for us to end those practices and the policies that uphold them. And so I think we are in these moments, and I think every generation ends up in a moment where they're asked about what are you going to do about it, right? Yes, we need to learn about it. And then we decide, what are we going to do collectively about it? How do we harness each other's courage, right, to show up? You know, sit-ins isn't just for the past, right? We should be sitting in somewhere right now, right, to say that we need to change these policies. We need to change these practices. We need to interrupt business as usual. Like, so there are things that we can do. We need to be calling our legislators and our representatives. We need to stop voting in people who won't vote the way that we need them to vote so we can have the kind of society that we want to have, right? So there's lots that we can do. And really, the time is nigh. It's now. So thank you for that, Barb. It's important to learn our history. That's why we can't ban books, right? To learn about those histories, we need to know where we came from and what happened to us so that we can carve out the better future that we want to have. So absolutely.
I'm amazed to look down at the clock and see that the music is about to play. And so let me say that if you've got more questions, comments, we're about to move to our second hour. We have a whole new lineup of guests coming in, including Rochester Mayor Malik Evans, the interim superintendent of RCSD, Aqua Porter, the executive director of RMAPI, Simeon Bannister from the Rochester Area Community Foundation, all joining us in our second hour. First, I can ask our live audience here to thank our guests who joined us this hour. Danielle Jones, Reverend Myra Brown, Dr. Ashley Cross, thank you all for being here. And we've got more connections live from MCC and the RMAPI Summit coming up.